session. Very important to me, interestingly. Well, interesting to me. but the first speaker is going to be John Heaton. He was a founding member of the Guild of Psychotherapists and was Director of Training of the Philadelphia Association, and has contributed many talks at Surrey University and Roehampton University, which I've had the great pleasure to listen to. And then there'll be a presentation, joint presentation by Phil Lowenthal and Robert Snell, who were both my research supervisors. So I look forward to hearing that. And finally, the respondent is Vici Benvenuto on my left here, and who wrote a book which is exceedingly useful for me in my training on the car with Robert Kennedy or
Roger
Kennedy. So, but we'll kick off now, if you may, with John Heaton speaking about Wittgenstein and the implications for the training of psychotherapists.
Okay,
thank you.
Is that all right? Okay, some people here. Well, I feel I'm a bit of a fraud at this meeting, as I'm asked to give a brief talk on how to teach Wittgenstein's way of therapy. Yet he's hardly mentioned in Dell's book or in the papers of this meeting. For example, Dell writes, this would include turning to ideas developed by individuals such as Levinas, Derrida, Foucault, Wittgenstein and Lang. Now, I think this sort of blurring of philosophers can create confusion. For example, Wittgenstein's group were mostly French philosophers, but he came from a completely different tradition, as I'll show. And he knew no French, and he probably never read Descartes. And the next thing is, I'm a very unclear what's meant by post-existentialism. I'm sure Wittgenstein would have been horrified to be shown under such a label. He was certainly a close reader of Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, and Dostoevsky, all classical existentialists, and we know he studied them very carefully. But he never called himself an existentialist. Was he one? Heidegger said that if Sartre is an existentialist, then he's not. The professor of existentialism in this country hasn't spoken to me for about 20 years because I've criticized it. So, you know, we're not on talking terms. So that, I mean, it's very difficult to say what an existentialist is. And I think the label post-existentialism is a motley. I know very few therapists who really practice anything like what Kierkegaard and Nietzsche thought was important. For example, the crucial importance in Kierkegaard of indirect communication, a very, very important notion, which is very, very important in Wittgenstein. And in Nietzsche, the importance of style in philosophy. He thought it was very, very important in philosophy of how you wrote the style. And of course, Wittgenstein entirely agreed. Wittgenstein was a highly literary philosopher, was well known. He took huge care, and he said that philosophy should be really written as poetry. And he thought that philosophy is far closer to poetry. Now, so I'll quickly give a brief and more orthodox account of where Wittgenstein comes from. I agree with Zizek and many others who say that we, Wittgenstein, everyone here, is still under the influence of German idealism and have not left it behind. He shows that Wittgenstein and Lacan are two principal contemporary players in coming to terms with it. One, Lacan, coming from the French tradition, Wittgenstein coming from German, English, American tradition. And again, of course, those traditions are very, very different. I mean, there's a book just been written by a very well-known French philosopher, in which he equates Lacan and Wittgenstein, and says in some ways that they're the greatest enemies of what he considers the. But this is very confusing to me, and I know to other people, because I can't see very much relationship between Wittgenstein and Lacan. I believe Lacan just read him a little and said he's insane. Which is, you know, rather common response to him. So Wittgenstein usually seems part of the semantic tradition. He's a sort of post-Kantian semantic tradition. And the semantic tradition started in the middle of the 19th century when mathematicians and philosophers began to criticize Kant's notion of the synthetic a priori, especially in relation to mathematics. But Kant thought that mathematical judgments are synthetic. In other words, he thought that the structure of experience is something the human mind supplies, which we nevertheless intuit directly. So experience of the world forces the intuition of the structure, and because the knowledge it brings is of the world, it's synthetic. In other words, it's roughly speaking what he means by synthetic. It's a sort of synthesis between the mind and the world. So Kant's emphasis on the human mind as central was hugely important and influenced the psychologism of the 19th and 20th century, and so Freud and Jung. Freud and Jung both thought at the beginning of the 20th century that psychology was the basic science, and that we should all be sort of psychologists. Psychology was at the root of experience. Now, Wittgenstein and the semantic tradition absolutely criticized this, that psychologism and psychology are really dirty words to them. The critic showed that a priori knowledge can't possibly be what Kant thought it was. It didn't lie in the constitutive powers of the mind, nor in empirical considerations. That they thought it was language that is crucial. So semantics and not metaphysics was their primary concern. In particular, the key to the a priori lay in the appreciation of the nature and the role of concepts, propositions, sense and nonsense. So one of the central things in Wittgenstein, of course, is the difference between sense and nonsense, or between sense and what we can't say, what is unsayable. I mean, he'd have been quite interested in one of the earlier papers who were concerned with what is the ineffable. How can you talk about the ineffable? If you talk about the ineffable, must be talking nonsense, because of course, by definition, the ineffable can't be talked about. But the ineffable, as he pointed out, is absolutely crucial in human life. It is what we talk about, he says, is just on the top of the ineffable. And the point of philosophy is to try and, if you like, talk about the ineffable. And so he can end his Tractatus, which is an excruciatingly difficult book, the only book he wrote, by saying, anyone who understands me will understand that every proposition I've said in this book is nonsense. So that there's a huge paradox here, which of course has produced a huge literature. How can you talk about nonsense? How can you talk about what cannot be said? Well, that you can't talk about, and yet it's basic to human life. So Frege was the... So it was, first of all, roughly speaking, the mathematicians who saw this, because of the big troubles of mathematics in the early 19th century. There were huge muddles about infinity and so on and so forth. And it was the mathematicians who first moved this, because mathematics is a language. And mathematicians, especially pure mathematicians, are very, very interested in the language of mathematics. So Frege was the first one really to begin to really criticize this, and Bertrand Russell had broader interest. But Frege was only interested in maths. He knew that all what he was saying was important in other areas, but he was a mathematician and really wasn't interested in that. Russell was a bit more interested, but of course Wittgenstein was the crucial person who showed the importance of this thing to not only to logic and science, but to art and how we live. So he was opposed to the whole notion of the a priori. Now, let me try and give you a rough... I mean, this is a very, very difficult subject, so I'll give you a rough idea. So most people in our culture believe that the world in which they live is just there. They think it's real. There rarely are tables, chairs, stars, thoughts, internal objects, etc. And this is what Kant believed. All language has to do, they think, is to fit into the real world, so that they think that there's a sort of correspondence between the real world and language. A child learning language, it is thought, has to match the words to the things in the world. He has to learn, well, that's a cup and that's a spectacle and so on. So it's a match. This is completely assumed, certainly by Freud and Jung Klein, all take this picture for granted, as it was masses of people do. Freud, for example, is always talking about reality, which he seems to think, sometimes anyway, seems to think analysts have exclusive knowledge of reality. Now, of course, reality, to anyone with a philosophical background, is a very, very suspicious it's a very tricky word. Now, I have no time, I can't discuss the whole details of this. But I'll point out that one of the main things into this is that it's a model of learning a second language. You see, if I want to learn Chinese, I can say, well, what's the Chinese for this? What's the Chinese for that? How do you say in Chinese, where's the way to the toilet, etc., etc.? So I know it is a language, and I know it will enable me to get around China. I know that language gives names to things, and I'll go to an expert to learn it. But as Wittgenstein points out, he said all philosophical problems really come back to infancy. He said always, if you've got a big problem, go back to seeing how you learn it, see how that language is learned. But the point about an infant is that he does not know what language is. So an infant does not learn language. He doesn't learn language. I can learn Chinese, well, probably too old to do so, but I could learn Chinese. So an infant doesn't know what language is. It does not know that, let's say, things have names. It doesn't know what a name is, etc., etc. And so Wittgenstein emphasizes we don't teach children's language. It is not a pedagogical activity at all. He uses sometimes the word I quite like, is we initiate a child into language by speaking and acting with it. It's interactional and dialogical and not pedagogical. So this is obviously has a lot of to do with therapy, because you can't teach. We don't teach a person who's obsessive how to stop being obsessive. It's much more complicated than that. So some years ago, I told an analyst that Wittgenstein thought that Freud had invented a new notation. This man was angry and said Wittgenstein had insulted the old man, and anyway, Wittgenstein was probably insane. I was a bit amazed, because notations are crucial in mathematics. Wittgenstein wrote more on mathematics than anything else. He was mathematicians who first recognized his importance. Mathematicians at Trinity supported him more than the philosophers did. Turing, one of the greatest mathematicians of the day, attended his lectures. Gödel, one of the most important people, studied the Tractatus for a year before he published his famous theorems in 1931. And there's a huge literature on Wittgenstein and mathematics. Now, one of the most important things mathematicians do is to create new notations. Think of the Arab numerals. If you ever try to go work with the Latin system and compare it with the ordinary Arabic numeral, you'll see the enormous importance of the... and you can go again and again. Think of Newton's fluxions. In the calculus, he used fluxions against Leibniz's dy/dx notation. The English sentimental attachment to Newton's notation held back mathematics in this country for a century, allowing the French and Germans to go ahead. Or Descartes' invention of Cartesian coordinates, which coordinate numbers with geometrical objects, etc., etc. So that Wickersant's work can be understood as introducing a new notation to make understandable basic insights on logic and the way language works. He remarked once, Ramsey, who was a mathematical friend of his, doesn't comprehend the value I place on a particular notation any more than the value I place on a particular word, because he doesn't see that in it an entire way of looking at the object is expressed. Now, this has been linked with an experience that certain psychoanalysts know of, and therapists of knowing, finding the right word. See, he was very, very concerned with finding the right word. And very often, in therapy, that's very crucial. One sort of fiddles around, and perhaps the patient does too, you know, just what this is. I mean, then they say a certain word. Oh, that's it, they say. Is that it? And this is a very therapeutic thing, and that is what Wittgenstein tries to do in philosophy. So a notation gives us a way of looking at things, an angle from which to look. For example, take the Oedipus complex. If a man has certain difficulties in getting on with women, it may be very useful to point out to him at an appropriate time, etc., that he treats women as if they were his mother. Now, this is, Wittgenstein would say, it's a notation, that Freud invented a notation. He invented ways of talking. He was faced with a population, or with many people who would faint at the word sex, for example. So, very cleverly, he produced a sort of whole notation in which sex was primary. Of course, this has fallen out now, because we can have pretty well every film you go to, you have people having sex, and you can watch sex on the computer for 24 hours a day, if it takes your fancy. So that nowadays ladies don't faint at the notion of sex. But, of course, as has been often pointed out, there is many sexual troubles or nowadays we call them relationship troubles, as ever there was. So psychoanalysts, of course, have moved on, and people now talk in terms of the real self, not necessarily the real self, but you know, in other ways. Incidentally, I read in a recent dictionary of Kleinian thought that internal objects, etc., are like the ungraspable particles of subatomic physics. Now, this is quite wrong. It's basic to quantum mechanics that electrons, etc., have no physical reality. This is one of the things, most important things, that our physicists have found out. They don't exist in, that there are no such, there's not such a thing in as electron. They only exist in the realm of the possible and can only occur when a measurement is made. And furthermore, they can, as most people know now, they're both particles and waves. So to talk in that sort of language, you need special notation. And interesting enough, someone was telling me that they met on a train, a person who saw that the book that they were reading was about Wittgenstein. And he said, he works at CERN, he's a physicist. He said, a lot of us read Wittgenstein here. Because, of course, Wittgenstein was a quantum physicist, he certainly wasn't, but because he shows us a way that our world is created by language. We're completely linguistic creatures, but the tendency is that the way we see the world, which is linguistic, is how the world really is. Do you understand? It's as if we've got spectacles on. We've got linguistic spectacles. So we look at the world, and we can't help but look at the world through spectacles. Now, the trick is that people say, does Wittgenstein enable you to take the spectacles off? Well, he doesn't, and you can't. Because if you think of it, to take the spectacles off and say, well, I see intuitive reality or something or other, is, of course, again, language. Do you understand? We're trapped, trapped in language. So philosophical progress, according to Wittgenstein, is the movement away from the illusions and delusions that continually settle on people. It's not a program towards the truth. He would say that is the job of science. And this raises a worry about Dell's program of moving towards a non-foundational therapy. Because to a Wittgenstein ear, you see, it sounds like another metaphysical proposition. We're going to move to a non-foundational therapy. But actually, none of us know what non-foundational therapy is. It's got an aim. And what one means by non-foundational therapy is much more to be aware of, if you like, the different languages, the different ways people speak, for example, different notations, if you like, and how, of course, French can bring up certain things that English can't express very well, and Chinese, and above all, most interesting in many ways, are languages like Aborigine language and American Indian languages, because they're so very different from us, because they have such a different way of living that their languages are very, very different. And so they show so that they can talk of certain things which we just can't talk about at all. And of course we can talk about lots of things like computers and quantum mechanics, etc., which they can't talk about. If you see what I mean. But you can't say, one of Wittgenstein's points is that you can't say which is more real, because he would say language is for practical use, that our language is for practical use. It enables us to get along fine, and if I only spoke American Indian languages, I wouldn't get along very well. I wouldn't really have a language to describe this sort of meeting, because of course they don't have meetings like this. So, how much longer have I got? So here's an excerpt from the film, Run Lola Run. And this is a quote from an introductory book on Wittgenstein's Tractatus, which illustrates quite well some of these things. So this is a dialogue between Lola and her boyfriend, Marnie. Lola says, "Do you love me?" "Sure I do." "How can you be so sure?" "I don't know, I just am. I could be some other girl." "No." "Why not?" "Because you're the best." "The best what?" "The best girl of all the girls in the world." "Sure." "How do you know?" "I just do." "You think so?" "Okay, I think so." "You see?" "What?" "You aren't sure." "Are you nuts or what?" "What if you never met me?" "What do you mean?" "You'd be telling the same thing to someone else." "Okay, if you want to hear it." "I don't want to hear anything. I want to know how you feel." "Okay, my feelings say that you're the best." "Who are your feelings anyway?" "It's me, my heart." Your heart says, "Hey, Manny, she's the one." "Exactly." "And you say, thanks for the information." "And see you around." "Exactly." "But you do what your heart says." "Well, it doesn't really say anything. I just know it feels." "So what does it feel now?" "That someone is asking stupid questions." "Man, you can't take me seriously." "Lola, what is wrong? Do you want to leave me?" "I don't know. I think I have to make a decision." You see, the point is, I remember, probably some of you have known, marital couple in which they try and measure out, how much do I love my wife? And it would go, if I wash the dishes, and do such and such. Then she may sleep with me a little bit. If I, and there's a great thing about who put the milk bottles out. And so, you know, it's a trying to measure love, you see. But love, so love is, of course, I don't need to say to this audience, it's a hugely important thing, I'd say. It's not a love isn't a thing, it's hugely important in human life. But you can't pin it down. It can't be pinned down. People who get along all right, and people can be sure that they're loved, but they can't be sure in the way that a scientist wants to be sure as to whether there really is a Higgs boson, which is a thing that is troubles in physicists at the moment, or not. They've got to be sure about that. And increasingly, I gather, they're not too sure about whether it exists or not. So you've got to do all sorts of things to try and make sure. Do you understand? You've got to do things. But what have you got to do to make sure that your wife loves you, or that you love your wife? How can you make sure on that? There's no sureness at all. And yet, in another way, you can be sure. Okay. So, yes. I'll say, so there are no, in other words, there are no limits to what Lola and Nanny can say to one another. They could go on forever trying to define whether they love one another. But there are empirical limitations. So the last thing I want to just suggest, which is a very important notion in Wittgenstein, is the difference between limits and limitations. This comes up again and again with patients. That a limitation is a thing between two empirical sorts of things. But my limits are to do with me, of what I can do. So to find one's own limits is not an empirical investigation. It is that that defines the difference between an empirical therapy, such as psychoanalysis, or some psychoanalysts think it is, and what, if you want to keep in the Kantian tradition, could be called a transcendental one. In other words, you can't define the transcendental. Okay.
Thank you.
Many thanks. So over to Del and Robert.
Are they on?
Well, thanks, Dennis. Thanks, John. Robert and I are talking about the training programs we provide. And I suppose following what John's saying, whether they're towards a therapy without foundations. We're actually primarily looking at phenomenology, and we're following it through humanistic, existential, psychoanalytic, postmodern, feminist ideas. Following phenomenology through that, in a sense, maybe, I don't know what John's saying, looking at different languages, and also being critical of these different responses. I think we don't stay with existentialism. John, I think, once defined existentialism as something that's astonishing and changing, and certainly most of existentialism in this country, I don't think, would warrant that definition. With regard to what we do, we have a BSc, an MSc, a PsychD, PhD programme. Been running since the 1980s, and it's influenced by a type of learning community model. In terms of academic and philosophical content, students follow, as I said, through phenomenology through to what we described as post-phenomenology, and along the way learn this humanistic, existential, psychoanalytic, and European postmodern thought. All our postgraduate students are actually in psychoanalysis and have psychoanalytic supervision, with the exception of the first year, where they have a more Rogerian phenomenological supervision.
Just thinking about our preparation for this, we were aware of using lots of different kinds of languages in the writing of this. And very often psychoanalytic language had very much crept in. Certainly it's my account of what you did, but it's probably because of my own training. In the process of putting this together, we found we've had to be quite reflective about that, and I don't know if this is to be very naive about Wittgenstein, but to be careful of what language games we were being caught up in. And I suppose that's part of the whole enterprise of the training, is that we engage in that kind of questioning with our students. We argue that the learning community is a container, psychoanalytic notion, for growth and development. At the same time, we take a more postmodern view that there is no fixed or stable centre. This can allow for a primacy on lived experience and the emergency of new ways of speaking about it, speaking the new rather than speaking what has already been said. On the postgraduate training programme at the Centre for Therapeutic Education at Roehampton, the learning community and group is involved in a training that stretches over a minimum of 4 years. Learning, we attempt to make experientially based as much as possible rather than primarily skills or knowledge based. It begins with questioning for what it means to be in the world of or with others.
The programme actually starts by inviting students to identify particular situations they want help with, and this leads to a lived inquiry through experience into relationships. Thus, there is a move in the training from an emphasis on thinking issues through to feeling to experience to unconscious and repression to our being subject to language and to each other, with ethical implications flowing from this. As in the practice of psychotherapy and other settings, the encounter with students can feel like it brings about an expansion of potentialities as people. We as staff are also subject, as one student recently put it, to something so big you can't see it. We are stretched to our limits in varying ways, with each student group angered, frustrated, despairing, moved in different ways. But it is just this rawness, if the higher education system can still enable it or allow it, that seems to be required for new experience and learning, both in ourselves and in the students.
There's something so big you can't see it, I guess it's something to do with limitations that we can't get beyond. It will be consistent with the emphasis placed on the experiential to start by trying to give a flavour of the students' and the tutors' struggles on the programme, the lived experience. We're going to offer you some fragments of dialogue, which we've done our best to alter so as to protect confidentiality.
I never realised I hated my mother so much for dying. It came to me as a complete revelation.
This could have come from a client or a patient in psychotherapy, who was in fact said by a student at the end of the first year. This was a student who had throughout the year appeared to the tutors very intransigent and resistant to learning. The tutors, who perhaps controversially, in terms of some other training models, take the part of group facilitators too in the large agenda-free group that's a central feature of the programme, for which we're talking particularly about today, I had experienced the student up to this point as attacking and aggressive. What was important was that she seemed to change into someone who could be insightful. In whose terms, we might ask. Her ability to think and feel, though, did seem to increase, and with it her openness to others and therefore, in our view, her capacity to become a therapist. After all, you have to take some responsibility for our view as to who we think is fit to become a therapist. What was the process and what was the nature of the labour that may have facilitated this emotional learning, enabling her to develop her ability to think?
The first year and the first days of the programme are, as you might expect, often critically important. In the first experiential group of 1 year of the course, a group member spoke of how the silence left him feeling as if he was
bursting, stifling, crying, breathing.
He and others voiced anger with the tutors for
dropping us in it. I don't want to play the tutor's game,
said one. She continued,
I'm determined to keep it down because Robert said I couldn't.
A response to the tutor's offering that her need to speak might be in order to prove that she was a second year diploma level and that she was above the other students. She was trying to prove him wrong, trying to show she could keep down what in fact she was showing perhaps she could not keep down. A great deal seemed to be opened up in 20 minutes with regard to her emotional constrictions.
At the same time, Robert needed to keep an open mind as to what he might be trying to keep down or getting drawn into, in terms, for example, of rivalry, and to be prepared to reflect on this, if not with the group, although that was a possibility, then with his colleagues and in supervision.
At the next meeting, there was some discussion of the previous group that a member had been in. A theme of unfinished business emerged, something that might constrain learning in the present group. If the group task, as the tutors formulated, was
to look at our experience of being in a group, experience that is beyond our experience,
what else might stop people learning from this? A member mentioned the holes in the carpet pattern, which he found himself counting, in order, a tutor wondered to him, to keep emerging feelings in check. An infinite black hole was perhaps being made finite, countable.
I keep looking at the black holes in the pattern on the carpet and counting them. Oh, and there's a bricked-up door in the building opposite.
No, I don't think it's a bricked-up door. Just a sort of recess in the wall.
He was perhaps internally bricking up doors that were not bricked up. Perhaps there was something he feared that needed to be blocked out, a potential in him. Someone else said,
I've been listing people's names in my head.
Another member, in the same meeting, kept her diary on her lap, as someone irritably pointed out to her. Blocks to learning, to listening to the emotional experience of being in the group, take different forms. If there's too much anxiety about what was, it's difficult to say with what is. If learning is beyond a person's experience, it is hard for them to feel that they can go beyond their experience. Barriers to learning are ways of protecting against fear of the unknown.
I haven't got my diary today,
commented the group member with the diary during the next meeting, the group member without the diary. People can start to learn that they do things that are about their own ways of defending themselves and not about the other person. Later in the same meeting, someone commented,
perhaps there could be something good here.
Meaning, as we understood it, something of value to be found in the group. Learning against how anxiety is protected against can work as an invitation to come alive. What, someone asked, was appropriate material or behaviour in the group? What may be thought to be appropriate, however, may be an inappropriate way of being. What might be most appropriate would be for the group to explore what its members consider appropriate.
So at each point we try to deconstruct theory and question it phenomenologically as we introduce it.
It might, for example, seem appropriate for group members to express concern over an absent colleague. It might, for example, in Rogerian terms be considered appropriate empathy, even advanced empathy, to use that particular language. This happened within the same training group 6 months later, at the end of the second term of the first year. This particular absent member had hitherto been almost completely silent in the group. The previous week, a far more talkative member had said,
the group's like a forest. Some members go out looking for food, and others wait to be fed.
When the silent member did return after a week's absence, the talkative member said,
we were worried about you. You weren't here last week. You're always so quiet.
Well, I felt I was being got at and accused of being a parasite waiting to be fed.
I wasn't wanting to get at you. I felt crushed and silenced in my family. And maybe that's why I talk so much.
The tutors posed the question in the group as to how much people's concern for the absent member, particularly perhaps the talkative student who'd made the forest analogy, was not for the absent silent member at all, but for themselves. How much, the tutors asked, were group members using the absent member as a receptacle for their own anxieties about being got at in the group by the tutors? Speaking in the group, as some members reported, can often be experienced as dangerous for this reason. The incident described was the occasion for a wide variety of learning. For example, personal learning for the silent member about the anxieties he brought to the group from his past experience, and group learning about rivalry and competition for scarce resources.
The silent member was able to put into words how pinioned and silenced he had up to now felt in the group. A possible result, a tutor offered, not only of his personal history, but also of an interpersonal phenomenon. The group members' projections of their painful past experiences of having been silenced. The student who coined the analogy of the forest had in fact recently shared with the group how much she felt her talkativeness was to make up for having felt crushed and silenced in her original family.
Crucially, what was opened up was a question about members' motives for becoming therapists at all. Did this come from a wish to help people? How might this wish be a kind of cover story for getting help with one's own damage? This seems to us to be a fundamental and mandatory question for any programme claiming to offer training in psychotherapy. And we don't know of a more potent way of opening it up than through the shared emotional labour, students and tutors, of an experiential group within the learning community. We argue, though, in our chapter in the book, that all the different kinds of meeting during the training, from seminars to group tutorials to business meetings, are aspects of the larger experience that constitutes the training.
Yeah. I think that's all from him.
To respond.
Right, we had two very interesting papers, even though they seem to come from two different worlds, even though they probably are aiming to something quite similar. That's, we don't know. John has pointed out what is Wittgenstein's linguistic term. While I think that Dell and his colleagues are somehow, let's say, going back, I would say, to the experiential. With that, I don't mean that they seem to ignore the function of language, but it doesn't come to the foreground. Because that preoccupation, obviously, when you do some experiment, when you are trying something new, is that you focus on the thing that that the other is not doing. And so I think that's job. The only thing I would like to, not to argue, but just to probably add to what you said, about Wittgenstein and Lacan, that a bit like John there, they couldn't really speak to it, use a language with each other. But in fact, they both are philosophers, the thinkers that imposed, you could say, a sort of linguistic term to psychology and psychoanalysis, in particular, in the case of Lacan. But strangely enough, these two linguistics, we could say, linguists, could not find a common ground. But that doesn't really concern us, in the sense that Wittgenstein enlightens John as Lacan enlightens me on many points. So we are not here to have a philosophical debate, the same way as Dell and the other Robert, and sorry, I can't remember all the names, are enlightened by certain philosophers, especially French post-existentialists. Which I can accept, is a term I can accept, why not? So this is, but this makes a point as regards the foundations. We all come from some foundations, which is different from challenging them. So they are two different even they don't belong to the same category. Psychoanalysis was born as a challenge to the foundation of the human mind. But before getting there, I would like to say something on training, even though I've been training is quite irrelevant at this point, but more the foundations for a training. But it's important here maybe to specify something. Training is the English word for what in the continental languages or more Romance languages is called formation, formation. Mm-hmm. And even though they are used as a translation, formation is, training is the translation of formation, because there isn't another word. Well, formation could be used, yeah? Language is also something that changes. Training, the definition of training is quite different from the definition of formation. Training offers a set of knowledge and competencies, learning of techniques based on foundations. It's very much founded. Training is fun. A foundation of what? Of a pre-constituted knowledge. There is a knowledge which is already there and is transmitted on to the other. And never as today, as some speaker was saying before, it aims at the qualifications, a title which can be recognized by the state as a legitimate trait. You are qualified for a legitimate trait. That is why the training is often a standard, has a protocol, standard, and has a formal program to follow. You follow the program, you do the things that you are told to do, and you are qualified. Formation has nothing to do with a training. Okay, this is the same for a lawyer, for an architect, for anyone. For the painter, someone was about, formation has other connotation. It's defined as a process of giving shape, professionally, morally, and structurally to the subject. It is an experiential as well as a learning process, whose only secondary gain is the acquisition or recognition of your competence, of a competence. This is a process which aims at altering the subject profoundly and cannot always be guaranteed by a set of ritualistic procedure. So the formation is not a set of procedure, even though procedure might be part of it, and we see how. This is a formation in general for French language and other languages, Latin source. The way Lacan used formation is yet more different. It's different even from the general definition of formation. And is, strangely enough, the formation for Lacan is the undoing of the foundations. It would be better call it an unformation, if you allow me to use this word, neology. That's why for a Lacanian, the core of formation is one's own personal analysis. That is the practice of the unmoving. That is very important. It's not the training function. We'll see. what the chain effect may be, might be, if we need one at all. Because for the Lacanian, personal analysis is quite enough. There you put everything at stake there. So, which is the proper practice, psychoanalysis, of this unforming, of this unshaping. There, where psychoanalysis is not based on the transmission of a body of knowledge to learn in order to become an analyst, rather involves the long and painful process of putting knowledge in question. This is how, for example, a Lacanian organization, London CIFAR, defines his own training. I quoted it from there. Psychoanalysis, in fact, is just a profession that does not have foundations. Born from the mind of a doctor who was concerned with the dreams, the tales, the love, the disappointments of those young women who used to be called hysterics. That's how psychoanalysis started. And Freud lost somehow his standing for doing that. What do? You just talk about young girls' love stories. But he thought that these love stories were the core of what he was inventing, or they were what? They were the material of this research. Probably the same way the demented woman could be for you later, after 20 years that you had worked with them. So training is not therapy. Where the unforming of the subject's fixed structures take place together with the emotional labor, as you call that, that goes with it. So it's true. An emotional labor goes with the work of analysis. But it can't be interpreted. That is probably the difference between you and I, right? Because it would be persecuting. I think, but I don't know. That is to be debatable. A training is always a setting up of new language games, to say within the Wittgenstein world. No matter what the technique each form of training uses, experiential or academic, doesn't matter. In any case, is a setting up of a language game. There is no language, I can say. There isn't a language that can account for all other languages. We are, how could we say, baited into language, and that's it, that specific one. There isn't a language above that can explain language. But there is only the use of language games. It is putting into practice the emergence of the new form that the subject is inventing from the ruins of his earlier foundations. Psychoanalysis training is a further stage from the analytical one, from the analysis, from the personal analysis. It is a rite of passage which recognizes a change of status from analysand to analyst. So it's not psychoanalysis because it's another stage. But still, it's a passage, it's a rite of passage. And now, what does it mean, a rite of passage? I'll try to explain that. Rites of passage consist always in a loss, a castration. So it's a castrating moment. Right? that welcomes you, though, in the social bond, to be with the others, to be able to swim in the sea of sociality. Psychoanalysis does not believe in a relation with the other, which is uncontaminated by the by what pre-exists the two subjects in question, or the two subjects in labor, say. What pre-exists them is a symbolic dimension which possibly is not working for at least one of them, possibly for neither of them. There are bad foundations, that's true. There are bad foundations, or not always adequate to the subjects, or to what is the building, the wished for building of his or her own life. You know, some foundations are not adequate. For some they are, and they don't come to analysis. Psychoanalysis does not build new foundations, that's the point. Gives the subject the opportunity to rebuild new, more flexible ones, possibly. Work of deconstruction implies always a reconstruction works. Deconstruction is not just an operation that you have done and that's done. They are only in the void, in the ruins, of the old foundations which were not good or which were not even there. One has to reinvent, create oneself. A house without foundations would collapse, but also a house with a bad foundation, too rigid, not able to withstand earthquakes, storms, or even less, is also a collapsing house.
Sorry, no, I thought that was off. Obviously it wasn't.
Okay, I have to go back to the topic. A training accompanies. Now I go very, very fast. Okay? A training accompanies the subject in his rebuilding works, from which is emerging a desire to be an analyst. That is why in psychoanalysis there is no training without analysis, and one which has been undertaken earlier than the training itself. The trainee has to arrive at the training already with his analysis and goals. Does therefore training consist only in teaching, only a form of education for the psychotherapist or the psychoanalyst to be? In a way it is. Freud thought that analyzing, governing, and educating are impossible professions. Why? I think because they had to unform a previous order of the mind. Governing is finding always new ways to manage the economy, the ethics, the repression, and enjoyment of a state. Education pushes you to abandon your old, more infantile knowledge and make a space for a new one. A training is the place where you have to negotiate your position, the way you want to deal with hierarchy, with teachers and peers, what you agree and don't agree, what interests you and what doesn't, where to make choices and be prepared to pay the cost for having learned them. So in a training, you're adult. In a training, you can be treated like neither an analysand nor like a child. And that is the rite of passage, really, because it's hard. It's a castrating experience. A training, I'm sorry, I have already made it there. In some, the training is not a place where you can have the position of the child. It is not an infantilizing place, but the field where you have to put yourself in the game.
I never get
there is no meta language and no meta game. That is, there is no game without. Sorry, I can't read here without my spectacles. Without, I introduce a term which, well, without the real, maybe what the others call the unknown, right? The real is the unknown. This, the training does teach, that there is the unknown, but the unknown we have to deal with. It's not something that you know, but it's something you have to deal with. Possibly I would like to go on, but I don't think I can. Time is gone. Okay.
Okay, so apologies for my poor timekeeping, but we've got about 8 minutes for questions, so who would like to ask those questions? One at the back. We turn this one off.
This is a question for John. I was very interested in what you said, and I'm saving up to buy your book.
What's the price on, not me.
Yeah, sure.
And it's the publisher who gets most of the bloody money, too.
Well, I mean, you said that the label of post-existentialism as a mockery and the Wittgenstein comes from a different semantic tradition. Now, my understanding is that in recent years, some interesting philosophy has come out of these different traditions, the analytic tradition, the continental tradition, sort of finding each other. And, for example, Richard Rorty sees an affinity between later Wittgenstein and early Heidegger. So I wondered what you thought of that link, and if you thought that link could be useful for therapy.
Well, yes, I agree. Of course, Wittgenstein's a bit of a puzzle, because he was a continental person. After all, he's an Austrian, so he doesn't usually go under continental philosophy. I mean, he's over here. But there are lots of links. I mean, it's known that Wittgenstein defended Heidegger at meetings of logicians who said that Heidegger was nonsense. And Wittgenstein absolutely disagreed. And Gadamer told me that Heidegger in his later years read Wittgenstein and said, he is the 20th century philosopher for me. So there are all sorts of things. There are all sorts of connections between them. I mean, there's many, many PhD theses will be written on this. So I would say, yes, it is a very, very interesting game. But there is quite a lot of writing on this. You know,
Useful for therapy?
What?
Useful for therapy?
Oh, yes. I think I would, of course, say Wittgenstein is better for therapy than Heidegger. Partly, of course, because he writes, he's much more familiar to English people. He writes in a, he doesn't ever have the continental grand thing. You see that Heidegger, like Lacan, would lecture to huge audiences. Wittgenstein refused. He would have never spoken at this audience. He would only speak to very small audience. He was invited to give the John Locke lectures at Oxford, which is prestigious, and you get £10,000 for it, and he refused. He said, what have I got to say to Oxford people? He was very, very interactive, if you like to use a rather jargony word, which is one of the differences between him, I suppose, and Lacan, although there are many relations. I mean, for example, because I would entirely agree that philosophy is not a body of knowledge. He said, if you want knowledge, do science. It's scientists who produce more knowledge, not philosophers. philosophers haven't produced one iota of knowledge between Plato and the present day. It's just not their thing, so to speak. And he would, of course, entirely agree that there's no meta-language. This is one of his arguments against Russell and people who are very keen on meta-languages. So he would agree with Lacan. I mean, there are a whole lot of things. I was thinking, I just remember the name Badois. Who's a French? He who's written a recent book, which has been published in English, about Wittgenstein and Lacan. But basically, Wittgenstein. To him, of course, Wittgenstein is the greatest enemy. He says the only person worthy of me, Badois, tackling is Wittgenstein. So you can take it as a compliment.
Do we have another question? Anybody?
Everyone's looking at the clock there.
Can you not say that formation is actually, or actually training comes underneath formation somehow?
Or it comes.
Comes underneath as a bit integrated into formation or formation. Mm. I mean, and the fact that When you have formation, you are building something. If you want to see it like plaster scene, for example, so you are reshaping, so you're reforming what was already there. But that's because of the training that you get to reshape. So, or do you think they're just really different notions?
We tend to get confused between the training, the role of the training, and the role of the analysis. I insist, the training is not an analysis, and probably is a transmission of knowledge, of a set of knowledge. Which you are free to accept or not. Then I haven't finished my paper because then later I will come to more complications, but probably is where your question comes from what I haven't said. because transference comes into it, of course. And transference is something where the subject wants a shape, is asking for a shape, forcing love with the shape. Say, okay, my shape is not good enough, I'll get yours. Okay? So I'll be just like you. And that happens to the trainee. So even if the trainee is in analysis, so it's already in transference, but it's a different kind of transference, with the trainee is a transference with knowledge. Mm-hmm. While in analysis is not the transference of knowledge, even though someone can enter an analysis, say, I come here to know more about myself. When subject says that, either they are lying, or you can say, okay, go to university, don't come here, right? Means that you don't want an analysis, because I am not offering any knowledge, but as we, I said before, but we are going to put in question the knowledge you already have. While the training, in a way, offers what the analysis does not offer. See, that's why it's a very difficult space, the training, because the students are in transference with you or with the thought that you represent, very much with the thought represent via you. You know, you are an instrument of that. And undoing that is what would the training do to undo that? It doesn't do anything. A training is a choice. That's why I end my, you know, I say everyone gets the training on the training one deserves. and we have to accept that choice.
Thank you.
Okay, well, that's, we've run out of time. I think the concluding remarks for Dr. Estelle was to say a few words.
Well, I hope you got the comfort you deserve. I would like to just, which you were saying earlier, a couple of things I think really interesting about the undoing of the foundations. I think the formulation is the analysis of the practice of the undoing. I think that was really, thank you for that. It's a couple of just thoughts from that, really. I mean, one is that I think that my understanding is both Wittgenstein and Heidegger both were interested in ordinary language, and the extent to which we're able to use ordinary language in our work, not technical language. And there's a whole question of what language do we need to get into in order to get to that. Which I think, if you understand, it's, can we just do it with ordinary language? Mm-hmm. I think that's one area. And another is that the very foundations, there are foundations, there are patients' foundations. And so often I think patients come to us because their foundations haven't been always what they might have thought was good enough or whatever, what might have been good enough. And yet they often come to us precisely holding up in lights the foundations that have caused them inadequate foundations. Yeah? I don't know if you can see what I'm saying. But so that the issue turns out to be somebody who they regarded as very much a foundational. And I suppose there's a question for ourselves with our own theories, is to what extent our own theories prepare us for this world we're in, of a very alienated world, and to what extent we can be with people and explore meanings and experiences, and to what extent our trainers and our theories get in the way of that and provide us with a sufficient foundation to be able to let go of some of those foundations.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.